Why?
Well, it's just that I saw a friend of mine last night. He's a street cruiser, doesn't work any house, and he said something that reminded me of what you said.
Rushed as I was, I took the time to sit down and grab a pencil and paper. Go on, Joseph.
He said a man had promised to, well, what you said, take him away and all that. Said he was going to live in a big, I don't know, castle or something, where he'd be able to see the whole city and laugh at everybody who ever did him a wrong turn. So it reminded me of what you said, and I asked him if the man had anything wrong with his face. But he said no. You sure about that thing with the face?
Yes, at this point.
Uh-oh, Scotch Ann's yelling. It looks like I've got a customer. Gotta go, bye.
I replaced the earpiece of the phone and shot out of our headquarters. Number 155 Baxter Street was an unremarkable New York tenement, though in any other neighborhood the women and children who were hanging out of its windows on that seasonable night would have been laughing or singing or at least screaming at each other. Here they simply sat with their heads in their hands, the youngest of them looking as worldly and tired as the oldest. A man who I placed at about 30 was seated on the stoop, swinging a nightstick that looked to be authentic police issue. It wasn't difficult to judge, after getting a glimpse of the man's blow-twisted features and surly grin, just how he'd laid hands on the trophy. After the Isaacsons joined us, I mounted the stoop, and the end of the nightstick poked my chest just hard enough to stop me from going further. The man's breath reeked of camphor-laced liquor.
Business?
We're here to see a resident.
Don't get gay with me, swell. Business?
I paused before answering. Who are you supposed to be?
I'm supposed to be the mug what watches this building for the landlord, so don't get gay with me, boy, lest you want to taste this sap.
He was speaking in the Bowery slang long since immortalized by the city's toughs, a language that was always a little difficult to take seriously. Still, I didn't like the look of the nightstick and went for my billfold. I held some money out. Top floor in the back. Anybody home? The man grinned and took the cash.
You mean old,
He suddenly began to blink, and then to comically contort his right jaw, cheek, and eye. Apparently unsatisfied with the results of this performance, he heightened its effect by tugging at his head with his hands. Pleased with this additional effort, he began to laugh out loud.
Nah, he ain't there. Never there. Not nights. During the day sometimes, but not nights. He can check the roof. Maybe he's up there. Likes it up there, does that bird.
Well, what about his flat? Maybe we'd like to wait for him there.
Maybe it's locked.
I held out more money.
Then again, maybe it ain't.
The man started into the building.
Ain't cops, is yous?
I'm not paying you to ask questions. The man gave my words something that approached consideration, then nodded.
Okay, come on with me. But keep it quiet, right?
We all nodded and followed the man inside. The building's long, darkened staircase was redolent with the stenches of rotting refuse and human waste, and at its foot I paused to let Sarah get in front of me.
A world away from Bank Street, isn't it, John?
We got up the 6 flights of stairs without incident, and then our guide knocked on one of the 4 doors that branched off a small landing. After getting no reply, he held up a finger.
Wait here a minute.
He loped up the final flight of stairs to the roof. In seconds, he was back, looking more relaxed.
All clear.
He took a large ring of keys from his hip pocket and unlocked the door.
Had to make sure he weren't around. He's a touchy one.
Instead of saying a name, the man began to contort his face again, which gave him another laugh. Finally, we entered the flat. A kerosene lamp sat on a shelf by the door, and I lit it. The space that slowly became visible was essentially one narrow hallway, perhaps 30 feet in overall length, in the middle of which had been built a small partition and a doorway with a transom over it. 2 recently cut chinks in the side walls, dictated for back tenements by new city regulations, were the flat's only connections to the outside world, offering limited, bleak views across narrow air shafts into similar gaps in the walls of neighboring flats. A small stove was set up against the partition, though there were apparently no sanitary facilities other than a rusted bucket. Coats of thick, cheap paint had chipped and peeled away from the walls, revealing each other and creating the overall impression of a brown stain, such as one might find at the bottom of a commode. In this place lived the being who had once been Japheth Durie, and was now the murderer, John Beecham. And within this spare little hole, there had to be clues, difficult as they might be to see. Without speaking, I indicated the far end of the flat to the Isaacsons. They each nodded, then proceeded past the partition and into that area. Sarah and I took a few tentative steps toward the old desk, while our guide remained alertly at the front door. Our entire search could not have taken more than 5 minutes, so small and sparsely furnished was the place. The old desk had 3 drawers that Sarah began to check in the near darkness, putting her hands in each to make sure she missed nothing. Above the desk, tacked to the crumbling wall, was some sort of a map. I was able to recognize the outline of Manhattan, but the marks that had been drawn over that outline were strange to me, a series of straight, intersecting lines with arcane numbers and symbols scribbled in at various points. I was about to put my head closer when I heard Sarah say, "Here, John." Looking down, I saw her remove a small wooden box from the bottom drawer. She placed it on the desktop rather fearfully, then stood away. Affixed to the lid of the box was an old daguerreotype, very similar in style and composition to the Civil War work of the eminent photographer Matthew Brady. Based on the picture's aged and battered condition, I judged it to be about the same vintage as Brady's work. The image displayed was that of a dead white man, scalped, eviscerated, and emasculated, with arrows protruding from his arms and legs. His eyes were missing. There were no identifying marks on the picture, but it was obviously one of the Reverend Victor Durie's creations. The box on which the daguerreotype was mounted was closed tightly, but there seemed to be an aroma emanating from it. My heart sank as I laid hold of the thing, although before I could open it, I heard Marcus's voice. "Oh, no. God. How?" Then there were bustling sounds, and Marcus stumbled out to where Sarah and I were standing. Even in the lamplight, I could see that he was pale. In a few seconds, Lucius followed him, bearing something in his arms. "John, it's evidence." "Oh, shit. The news is cops." Without answering, I struck a match and held it high as I approached Lucius. Just as I focused in on the object in his arms, Sarah let out a short cry and then clamped a hand over her mouth, spinning away. Lucius was holding an enormous glass jar. Inside it, preserved in a substance that I could only suppose to be formaldehyde, were human eyes. Some still trailed their ganglia of optical nerves, and some were smoothly round. Some were fresh, others milky and obviously aged. Some were blue in color, some were brown, and others were hazel, gray, and green. But it was not the discovery or condition of the eyes I now understood that had stunned Marcus. It was their number. These were the dozens of eyes of more than a score of victims, and all of them were gaping through the curved glass in what seemed silent accusation, pathetically begging to know what had taken us so very long. In a moment, my own eyes wandered back to the small box that Sarah had found, which I now opened slowly. The stench of decay that wafted up was not so strong as I expected, allowing me to study the receptacle's strange contents without difficulty, but I could make no sense of what I saw. A small, red-black piece of what looked like desiccated rubber. "Lucius?" I held the box out toward him. Setting the large jar down on the desk, Lucius took the box over by the front door and held it under the kerosene lamp. "It is, I believe, the preserved remnant of a human heart. It's been in here for a very long time. It looks as though it may have even been coated with something, a varnish of some kind. I would suspect it is his mother's heart." I turned to Sarah, who was taking deep breaths and standing with her arms wrapped around her midsection. I touched her shoulder. "All right?" She nodded once.
"Yes, fine."
"Lucius, someone's got to check that stove. Can you manage it? Let me borrow a match." I gave him the little box from my pocket.
The rest of us listened as he went to the grimy black chunk of iron that stood against the partition. A few pieces of firewood were in a bin next to the thing, and a greasy roasting pan sat on top of it. Someone had apparently been cooking. Lucia struck a match, took a preparatory but calm breath, then pulled the door of the oven cavity open. I closed my eyes as he held the match inside. In another 15 seconds, I heard the door bang closed. Nothing. Grease, a charred potato, nothing else. I let out a lot of air and tapped Marcus's shoulder. What do you make out of this? I pointed to the map of Manhattan on the wall. Marcus studied it closely. Looks like a surveyor's map of some kind. Yes, it's a chart of the city's water supply system. Lucius rejoined us, and then we all stood in a tight circle away from the box and the jar that sat on the desk. That's all that was in the back? That's all, Marcus said. No clothes, nothing. If you ask me, he's gone. Could be he knew we were closing in. Sarah looked surprised. But why would he leave without taking all that evidence? Marcus shook his head. Maybe he doesn't think it is evidence. Or maybe he was in a hurry. Or maybe... I voiced what we were all thinking. Or maybe he wanted us to find it. That may be true, Lucius said. But we've still got to watch this place, in case he does come back. We should tell the commissioner to send other men down. We can treat this as a straight murder investigation now. All right, then. Sarah and I will get up to Mulberry Street and tell Roosevelt to assign men to watch this building day and night. Lucius, you and Marcus will have to stay here until that relief comes. And so Sarah and I dashed north, stopping at Mulberry Street to speak to Roosevelt, and then hurrying on to our own headquarters. When we entered number 808 Broadway, I was moving so fast that I failed to notice and nearly tripped over a rather large gunny sack that someone had left in the vestibule. Crouching down, I saw a tag attached to the closed top of the bag. 808 Broadway, 6th floor, it read. So the package was for us. I glanced up at Sarah and saw that she, too, was examining the sack and the tag. You haven't been ordering produce, have you, Joan? Don't be ridiculous. Must be something for Marcus and Lucius. I studied the sack for a few more seconds, then reached down to undo the twine that bound its mouth. The cord was twisted into a complex knot, however, so I pulled out a penknife and slit the thick fabric of the bag from top to bottom. Out onto the floor, like so much meat, fell Joseph. There were no obvious marks on his body, but the pallor of his skin made it instantly clear that he was dead. It took the coroner at the Bellevue morgue better than 6 hours to determine that Joseph's life had ended when someone jammed either a thin knife, such as a stiletto, or a large needle, up under the base of his skull and into his brain. A night spent smoking cigarettes and pacing the hallways of the morgue did nothing for my ability to make sense of this information when it finally came. I thought briefly of Biff Ellison, yet even in my shocked grief, I couldn't picture Ellison being responsible. I could think of no explanation and no culprit save one. Beecham. Somehow, he'd found a way to get close to the boy, despite all my warnings. My warnings. As Joseph's little body was wheeled out of one of the morgue's autopsy rooms, it occurred to me for what must have been the 1,000th time that it was meeting me that had brought the boy to such an unhappy end. I had tried to prepare him for every possible danger. But how could I have foreseen that the greatest of those dangers would be to speak to me in the first place? And now here I was at the morgue, telling the coroner that I'd arranged for a funeral and that everything was to be taken care of properly, as if it mattered whether the boy's body was buried in a nice patch of Brooklyn's ground or thrown into the tidal currents of the East River and pulled out to sea. Vanity, arrogance, irresponsibility. All through the night, my mind had been pulled back to what Kreitzler had once said to me, that in our dash to defeat evil, we only give it a wider field in which to run its own wretched course. Lost in these thoughts as I wandered out of the morgue and into the dawn, I was perhaps less surprised than I might otherwise have been to see my old friend sitting in his uncovered calash. Laszlo smiled and stepped down from the rig as I stumbled over. Joseph, I know. Sarah called. I thought you might need some breakfast. I nodded weakly and got into the carriage with him. I leaned back and rested my head on the folded cover of the calash, sighing heavily and staring at the half-lit, cloudy sky. It had to be Beecham. Yes, but there was no mutilation. I couldn't even see how he'd been killed. There was so little blood. Nothing but a small hole at the base of his skull. Quick and clean. This wasn't one of his rituals. This was pragmatic. He kills a boy to protect himself and to send a message. Desperate as he is, he won't go easily. But how? How? I told Joseph. Told him everything we'd learned. He knew how to identify Beecham. Hell, he called me in the afternoon to double-check on the details. Kreitzler's right eyebrow arched. Really? Why? I don't know. Some friend of his had been approached by a man who wanted to take him away to a castle above the city, he said. Something like that. It did sound like it might have been Beecham, but the man had no facial spasms. Laszlo turned away. Ah, then you didn't remember. Remember? Adam Dury. He told us that when Japheth was hunting, his spasms went away. I suspect that when he stalks these boys... Seeing the effect his words were having on me, Kreitzler cut his explanation short. I'm sorry, John. I clutched my head with both hands. Of course he was right. Hunting, stalking, trapping, killing. They all calmed Beecham's spirit, and that calm was reflected in his face. Whoever the boy, the street cruiser that Joseph had referred to was, he might in fact have been accosted by our man. Joseph himself certainly had been. All because I had forgotten a detail. Kreitzler put a hand on my shoulder as the calash rolled on. Abruptly he announced, Sunday night is the benefit for Abbey and Grau at the Metropolitan Opera. Morel will be singing Giovanni. We must attend. Kreitzler, it's the feast of St. John the Baptist. You know that. We're going to be hunting a murderer. Yes, yes, but later. Beecham hadn't struck before midnight thus far. There's no reason to think he will on Sunday. From the map you discovered of the water system, the Isaacsons have concluded that the next attack will be at the Highbridge Aqueduct and Tower. It does indeed resemble a tall castle turret. Police forces will be placed there in concealed positions, so we will be well prepared. Well, why not make our wait as pleasant as possible? Kreitzler, I don't know what's happened that's let you sit there and talk so casually about the opera as if you... The black eyes went dead, and a cool but ferocious sort of determination hardened the voice. There's nothing casual in what I'm saying, Moore. Just tell me, do you accept? Well, of course, I did accept. What else was I going to do? It is never easier to understand the mind of a bomb-wielding anarchist than when standing amid a crush of those ladies and gentlemen who have the money and the temerity to style themselves New York society. Suited, gowned, bejeweled, and perfumed, the fabled 400 top families in the city can shove, snipe, gossip, and gorge with an abandon the amused onlooker might find fascinating, but the unfortunate interloper will deem nothing short of deplorable. I was one such interloper on Sunday evening, the 21st of June. For 2.5 acts, and with confounding equanimity, Laszlo endured that boorish audience's ignorance of the musical miracle that was taking place before us. And then, just as Aramondi swept on stage and held a statuesque finger out toward Morel, with Seidel whipping the orchestra into a crescendo such as I have rarely heard, Laszlo calmly stood up, took a deep, satisfied breath, and touched my shoulder. All right, Moore, let's go, shall we? Go? Go where? I got up and stepped with him to the darkest recesses of the box. Kreitzler, we're supposed to meet Roosevelt after the performance and go with him to the Highbridge Tower. Kreitzler didn't answer, but calmly opened the door to the saloon, out of which stepped Cyrus Montrose and Stevie Taggart. They were dressed in clothes that closely resembled our own. I had a realization. These two were supposed, by supplying vaguely similar silhouettes, to give the impression that Kreitzler and I were still in the theater. But for what purpose? Where was Kreitzler rushing off to? Questions continued to proliferate in my head, but the man with the answers was already on his way out of the building. And so, with Don Giovanni bellowing in horror as he descended into the inferno, I followed Kreitzler to the Broadway doors of the Metropolitan.
His mood when I caught up to him was one of exhilarated determination.
We'll walk.
Kreitzler, damn it, you might at least tell me where we're going.
I should have thought you would have determined that by now. We are going to find Beecham.
The words hit me rather hard, making it necessary for Laszlo to grab me by my lapel and pull me along. As I stumbled with him to the curb and then waited for the traffic to let us cross, Laszlo chuckled.
Don't worry, John. It's only a few blocks, but that should give us enough time to attend to all your questions.
A few blocks? To Highbridge Tower? It's miles away. I tried to shake off my daze as we wound through horse manure and rolling carriages and finally got across Broadway.
I'm afraid Beecham won't be at Highbridge Tower tonight, Moore. Our friends are destined for a rouser. Frustrating vigil.
As we proceeded down 39th Street, the noise of Broadway faded behind us, and our voices began to echo off the darkened row houses that stretched on towards 6th Avenue. For a moment, Kreitzler managed to trade his enthusiasm for compassion.
I'm sorry about the others, John. Truly I am. If I could have thought of another way, but there isn't one. Please understand. If the police are at all involved in this, it will result in Beecham's death. I'm as certain of that as I am of anything. Oh, I don't mean that Roosevelt himself would play a part, but during the trip to the tombs or while he's in his cell, there will be an incident of some kind, a detective or a guard or some other prisoner, perhaps, probably claiming self-defense, will most assuredly put an end to the rather large set of problems that you and I have come to know as John Beecham.
But Sarah and the Isaacsons, surely they deserve...
I couldn't take that chance. They work for Roosevelt. They owe their positions to him. I couldn't take the chance that they wouldn't tell him what I was planning.
But when Roosevelt finds out that we've left the opera, he'll tear the city apart looking for us. Laszlo shrugged.
Well, he'd be better off using his head. He has the clues he needs to determine our whereabouts.
The clues? You mean the things in Beecham's flat? But it was what we found there that led us to decide on Highbridge Tower. That and the business about a castle that Joseph told me.
No, John. It was part of what you found at Beecham's flat that led you to such a conclusion. But think again. What did he leave behind?
The collection of eyes, the map, and the box with the daguerreotype on it.
Correct. Now think what conscious or unconscious considerations caused him to leave only those things. The eyes tell you unmistakably that you have the right man. The map gives you a general idea of where he'll strike next. And the box. What about the thing that's in the box?
The heart?
Yes. Now, put the map and the contents of the box together. The city water system and the heart. Now add what Joseph said.
A castle or a fort, a place from which you can see the whole city.
And?
As we turned and began to walk up Fifth Avenue, the answer hit me like a cartload of bricks. Stretching away for two blocks to the north and one block to the east, its walls as high as the buildings around them and as prodigious as those of the fabled city of Troy, was the Croton Reservoir. It was indeed a castle-like fortress, on whose ramparts New Yorkers often strolled, enjoying the splendid panoramic views of the city, as well as of the man-made lake within. In addition, the Croton was the main distributing reservoir for all of New York. It was, quite simply, the heart of the city's water system, the center to which all aqueducts fed, and from which all mains and arteries drew their supply. Astounded, I turned to Kreitzler, who smiled.
Yes, John. Here.
He pulled me in close under the walls of the reservoir, which were deserted at that hour. He looked up, and for the first time that night, displayed some little bit of apprehension.
If my guess is correct, he's up there now.
This early? I thought you said,
tonight is very different. Tonight he has set his table early, the better to be ready for his guests.
Reaching inside his cloak, Kreitzler produced a Colt revolver.
Take this, will you, Moore? But do not use it unless you must. There is much I want to ask this man.
Kreitzler started to move toward the massive main gate and staircase of the reservoir, which strongly resembled the entranceway
to an Egyptian temple of the dead. Given our purpose that night, the similarity caused a strong shiver to rattle my bones. Laszlo entered the gate and took the broad, dark stairs that wound up through the massive wall to the promenade. I was about to follow him when a faint glimmer of brass somewhere on the other side of Fifth Avenue suddenly caught my eye. I stopped short and tried to locate the source. On 41st Street, beneath a broad-boughed tree whose leaves provided an effective refuge from the glow of the arc street lamps on the avenue, was an elegant black brougham, whose lanterns were glittering ever so slightly. Both horse and driver appeared to be asleep. For a moment, the sense of dread that I felt about climbing the reservoir walls heightened dramatically. But then I shook it off and moved to catch up to Kreitzler, telling myself that there had to be a great many people in New York besides our gangster friend Paul Kelly who owned elegant black broughams. As soon as we reached the top of the reservoir's walls, I realized the potentially disastrous error I'd made in allowing Kreitzler to talk me into coming to this place alone with him. The 8-foot-wide promenade atop the walls, ringed on either side by 4-foot iron fences, was some 6 stories from the ground, and when I looked down, I saw the streets from an angle that instantly recalled all the rooftop work we'd done in recent months. That reminder was forbidding enough on its own. But when I looked straight out and around me, I saw the tarred surfaces and multitudinous chimneys of the buildings that surrounded the reservoir, all of which made it even more plain that while we might not be standing on a rooftop per se, we had nonetheless re-entered the lofty realm over which John Beecham was acknowledged master. As we strode silently down the 40th Street side of the walls, the waters of the reservoir stretching out to our right and reflecting a bright moon that had suddenly appeared and was still ascendant in the clear night sky, it became apparent that our status as hunters was in very serious jeopardy. We were on the verge of becoming prey. Despite all these anxious thoughts, however, I never once considered turning back. Perhaps Laszlo's conviction that we were going to end this business on those walls that night was infectious. Whatever the reason, I didn't leave his side, even though I knew, as certainly as I've ever known anything, that we stood an excellent chance of never returning to the streets below. We heard the sobbing before we saw the boy. There were no lights on the promenade, only the moon to guide us. And as we turned onto the 40th Street side of the pathway, a 1-story stone structure that had been built atop the walls to house the reservoir's control mechanisms loomed up spectrally in the distance. The sobs, high-pitched, desperate, and yet somehow muffled, seemed to be coming from somewhere near it. When we'd gotten to a point some 45 feet from the structure, I caught a vague glimpse of human flesh glowing in the moonlight. We took a few steps closer, and then I made out plainly the figure of a naked young boy on his knees. His hands had been bound behind his back, causing his head to rest on the stone surface of the promenade, and his feet were similarly tied. A gag had been wrapped around his head, holding his painted mouth open at a painful angle. His face was glistening with tears, but he was alive, and just as surprisingly, he was alone. Reflexively, I took a quick step forward, intending to help the unfortunate youth. Kreitzler grabbed my arm and held me back. "No, John. That is exactly what he intends for you to do." Kreitzler nodded, his eyes directing me toward the top of the control house. Rising just above the roof of the thing, and reflecting the soft light of the moon, was a balding head. I felt my heart jump, but quickly sucked in air and tried to stay calm. "Does he see us?" Laszlo's eyes had gone thin, but he betrayed no other reaction to the scene. "Undoubtedly. The question is, does he know we've seen him?" An answer came immediately. The head disappeared, the way an animal in the wild will do, completely and with astonishing speed. By now the bound boy had caught sight of us, and his stifled sobbing had changed to more emphatic sounds that, though incomprehensible as words, were plainly appeals for help. A picture of Joseph appeared in my head, doubling my already driving desire to go and help this next intended victim, but Kreitzler kept his grip on my arm. "Wait, John, wait. There are only 2 ways out of that structure, back onto the promenade, or down a flight of stairs to the street. If he doesn't appear..."
Another full minute went by with no sign of life. Kreitzler looked very puzzled. Is it possible he's run? Maybe the risk of actually getting caught was too much for him. Kreitzler weighed that, then studied the still pleading boy. All right, we'll approach, but very slowly, and keep that revolver handy. The first few steps we took down that stretch of the promenade were stiff and difficult, as if our bodies knew and were rejecting the danger that our minds had decided to accept. But after we'd covered 10 feet or so without catching a glimpse of our antagonist, we began to move more freely, and I became more convinced that Beecham had, in fact, been more intimidated by the prospect of capture than he had expected to be, and fled to the street. I felt a sudden, powerful feeling of joy at the thought that we were actually going to prevent a killing, and allowed myself a small smile. Hubris, as they say. Just as self-congratulation allowed my grip on the revolver to weaken ever so slightly, a dark form vaulted over the iron fence on the street side of the promenade and laid a stunning blow across my jaw. I heard a thunderous crunching sound, which I now realize was made by the bones in my neck as my head snapped around, and then all was darkness. I couldn't have been unconscious for very long, since the shadows thrown by the moon had not advanced significantly when I woke up. Nonetheless, my head felt groggier than if I'd been asleep for days. As my vision cleared, I became aware of several pains, some sharp and some dull, but all acute. There was my jaw, of course, and my neck. My wrists were burning, and my shoulders ached mightily. My head felt like a solid block of Pittsburgh steel, and I couldn't lift it more than a few inches. Eventually, I realized that this was due to more than the blow I'd received. My wrists were tied behind me to the top of the iron fence on the inner side of the promenade, and my ankles were similarly bound to the bottom of the iron divider, causing my head and upper body to hang out painfully over the stone pathway. Lying on the path was the Colt revolver I'd been holding. I groaned again and kept trying to lift my head, finally succeeding just enough to be able to turn and catch sight of Kreitzler. He was similarly bound, though he seemed quite conscious and unharmed. He gave me a smile. Are you back, John? Oh, where's... With effort, Kreitzler nodded toward the control house. The bound boy laid where we'd first seen him, though by now his urgent cries had reverted to fearful whimpers. Before him stood an enormous figure clad in unremarkable black clothing, whose back was to Kreitzler and me. The man was slowly removing his garments and placing them neatly to one side of the promenade. In a few minutes he was entirely naked, revealing more than 6 feet of powerful muscles. He stepped forward to the boy, who, judging by the adult lines that were beginning to show in the face and body, must have been about 12, and picked his painted head up by the hair. Crying? A boy like you ought to cry. The man released the boy's head and then turned to face Kreitzler and me. His anterior musculature was as fully developed as his posterior. From the shoulders down, he was a remarkable physical specimen. I strained my neck to look up at his face, furrowing my brow as I did. I didn't know precisely what I was expecting, but I certainly wasn't prepared for the banality of those features. There was something of Adam Dury in the way the skin was pulled tightly over the man's skull, as well as in the thinness of his hair. The eyes, too, were like his brother's, too small for the big, bony head. The right side of the face drooped a bit, though it wasn't at that moment spasming, and the big jaw was set firmly. But all in all, it was a common sort of face, one that exhibited no hint of the terrible turmoil that boiled without respite deep within the large head. He looked rather as though the construction of this horrendous scene was not altogether different from counting heads for the census. That fact, I suddenly realized, was the most frightening thing I'd yet learned about John Beecham. In a very businesslike manner, he bent down and took his enormous knife from out of his clothes, then walked over to where Kreitzler and I were hanging. His chiseled body bore very little hair, allowing it to reflect the light of the moon brightly. He stood in a wide stance, and leaned down to look first Kreitzler and then me in the face. He shook his head. Only two? Against me? That was stupid. Stupid. He lifted the knife and pressed the flat of its blade against Laszlo's right cheek, letting it play languorously around the lines of my friend's face. Laszlo watched Beecham's hand move. Japheth. Beecham growled viciously, and then brought the back of his left hand hard across Laszlo's head. "Don't you say that name." Beecham drew himself up and took a deep breath, as if he had felt his outburst had been somewhat undignified. For the first time, he smiled, showing huge, yellowing teeth. "You've been looking for me. You've been trying to watch me, but I've been watching you." The smile vanished as quickly as it had appeared. "You want to watch?" He indicated the boy with his knife. "Then watch. He dies first. Cleanly. Not you, though. You're stupid and worthless. You couldn't even stop me. Stupid, worthless animals. You I'll dress alive." As Beecham strode back to the boy, I saw that a small stream of blood was running down Kreitzler's cheek and jaw. "You all right?" Laszlo showed remarkably little concern over our prospective fates. "It's the stupidity that hurts the most. We chase a man who's an expert mountaineer, and then we're surprised when he negotiates a simple masonry wall to get behind us." Beecham was by now crouching over the bound boy. "Why did he take his clothes off?" Laszlo studied our attacker for a moment. "The blood. He wants to keep it off his clothes." Having put his knife aside for a moment, Beecham began to run his hands over the young, writhing body before him. "But is that, in fact, the only reason?" Beecham's face continued to betray no sign of anger or lust or any other feeling. He probed the boy's torso and limbs as an anatomy instructor might have done, pausing only when he laid hands on the young genitals. After fondling them for a few minutes, he stood and stepped behind the boy, stroking the upturned buttocks with one hand and his own member with the other. I grew sickened at the thought of what I believed must come next, and turned away. "But Laszlo, I thought he didn't rape them." "That may not mean that he hasn't tried to. This is a complex moment, John. He claimed in his note that he didn't soil the boys. But did he try?" I picked my head back up to see Beecham still stroking the boy and himself, failing to produce an erection in his own organ. "Well, if he wants to do it, why..." "Because he doesn't, in fact, want to. He feels an obsessive force pushing him toward it, toward the killing. But it isn't desire. And while he can force himself to kill, he can't force himself to rape." As if in response to Laszlo's analysis of the scene, Beecham suddenly howled in deep-seated frustration, raising his thick arms to the heavens and shaking throughout his body. Then he looked down again, stepped quickly around to the boy's front, and slipped his long-fingered hands around the young throat.
"No, no, Japheth, for God's sake, it isn't what you want to—"
"Don't say that name." The boy squealed and twisted madly in his grip. "I'll kill you, you filthy—" Suddenly from my left, a somehow familiar voice came out of the darkness. "You ain't killing anybody, you miserable bastard." Sore as my neck was, I turned quickly to catch sight of Detective Sergeant Connor, who'd been with us that first night at the Williamsburg Bridge. Connor walked down the promenade holding an impressive Webley .445 revolver. Behind him came two thugs. Connor's shifty eyes went thin as he stepped toward Beecham.
"Do you hear me? Get the hell away from that kid."
Very slowly, Beecham released his grip on the boy. His face became an absolute blank, and then it changed dramatically. For the first time in emotion, terrible fear became apparent in the widening of the eyes. Just when it seemed that those organs could open no further, they began to blink rapidly and uncontrollably. At the same time, Laszlo studied our apparent rescuer with a look of both hatred and satisfaction.
"Connor!"
Connor leaned over to pick up Kreitzler's Colt. He kept the Webley trained on Beecham,
as the man to his right moved somewhat grudgingly to free first Laszlo and then me. Beecham cowered against the wall. "And you, get your fucking clothes on, you blasted sodomite!" But Beecham made no move to comply. His expression became more fearful. He huddled closer to the wall, and then the spasming began. Initially it was slow, involving only the blinking of the eyes and a tug at the right corner of the mouth. But soon the entire right side of his face was contracting violently, and at a quick clip, producing a pathetic effect that I must admit would have seemed, under other circumstances, cruelly laughable. As he watched this transformation take place, a look of blatant disgust came into Connor's face. "My God, you sick, miserable bastard." Connor turned to the man on his left. "Mike, cover him up, for God's sake." The man went over, picked up Beecham's clothes, and threw them at him. Beecham grabbed the garments and held them close, but didn't try to dress himself. Once Laszlo and I were back standing on the promenade, we both spent a few seconds trying to loosen up our painfully cramped arms and shoulders, while Connor's thugs went over to stand behind their chief again.
"Aren't you going to untie the boy?"
Connor shook his head.
"Let's get a few things straight first, Doctor. Our business is with this one here," he indicated Beecham, "and only with him. You get on out of here, and there'll be nothing more to it. The whole business ends tonight."
"Indeed it does, but not in the way that you anticipate, I'm afraid."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning that our leaving is out of the question."
Chrysler took half a step forward. Connor gripped the Webley tighter.
"Don't do it, Doctor. Don't give me a reason. Like I say, we're only here to do this one, but if you give me cause, so help me, I'll shoot you down."
For the first time, Beecham seemed to fix his attention on what was happening around him. His face still spasming, he turned to look at Connor and his thugs. Then, in a sudden flurry, he scurried over near Laszlo's legs.
They're going to kill me."
Connor chuckled gruffly.
"Yes, it's dead you'll be when they take you off this wall, you damn fool butcher. All of this trouble over you, and what are you? A poor excuse for a man, with your whining and crawling."
Connor began to swagger a bit in front of his cohorts.
"Hard to believe, ain't it, fellas? That thing there is what this has all been about. Just because his idea of fun is to fuck little boys and then cut them up."
Beecham balled his fists but stayed in a crouching stance.
"Liar! You filthy liar!"
At that, Connor and his men began to laugh, exacerbating Beecham's emotional turmoil. As the mocking howls went on, I walked over to stand by Beecham without knowing why, then gave the three laughing fools in front of me a disapproving scowl that produced no effect. Turning to Kreitzler in hope of getting some guidance, I saw that he was staring down the promenade past Connor and his men, his face a picture of anticipation. His mouth fell open, and for no reason that I could divine, he suddenly shouted,
"Now!"
And then all hell broke loose. With the speed and precision that only years of professional training can breed, an ape of a man leapt up and over the inner promenade fence and crushed Connor's gun-wielding hand with a stout section of lead pipe. Before the other two thugs could react, several lightning combinations of blows from two enormous fists laid them both out on the promenade. The howling Connor soon shared the same fate. Then, just for good measure, the newcomer, his face hidden under a miner's cap, leaned over each man's head in succession and delivered a series of resounding blows with the lead pipe. It was a clinic in violence that was awesome to behold. But my joy at the attack faded considerably when the performer stood up and finally revealed himself. It was Eat-em-up Jack McManus, former prize fighter and current enforcer of decorum at Paul Kelly's new Brighton Dance Hall. Tucking his piece of pipe into his pants, McManus picked up both the Colt and the Webley, and then stepped toward me. I braced myself, reasonably calculating that Laszlo and I would be the next victims of his pugilistic artistry. Instead, McManus straightened his shabby jacket, spat hard into the waters of the reservoir, and handed me the guns. I trained the Colt on Beecham as Jack slowly walked up to Kreitzler, raised a hand, and touched the brim of his cap respectfully. Kreitzler congratulated him.
"Well done, Jack. Bind them, if you would."
At that, I almost hit the pathway beneath me in a dead faint.
McManus touched his cap again, crossed back in front of me, then produced several lengths of rope and two handkerchiefs and carried out Laszlo's instructions like a patient, laboring ox. Kreitzler, in the meantime, went quickly to the boy and began to free his mouth, hands, and feet. The youth continued to sob and whimper uncontrollably.
"It's all right. You are quite safe now."
The boy looked up at Laszlo, eyes wide with terror.
"He was going to..."
"What he was going to do is no longer important. What is important is that you are safe. Here."
Laszlo retrieved his somewhat mangled opera cloak from the promenade and wrapped it round the shaking young man. Jack McManus had finished the job of binding Connor's men, and he looked to Kreitzler expectantly. "Well, Jack, all secure? Good. We won't be needing you further, but, again, my thanks."
McManus touched his cap one last time, then turned and strode back down the dark promenade without saying a word. Kreitzler turned to the boy again.
"Let's get you inside, shall we? Moore, I'm just going to put our young friend here in the control house."
I nodded, keeping the colt leveled at Beecham's head as Laszlo and the boy disappeared inside. Still huddling and spasming, Beecham had begun to let out a quick, guttural little whimper of his own. It didn't appear that he'd give me any trouble, but I wasn't taking any chances. Quickly scanning the area, I saw his knife lying on the pathway, and moved to pick it up and tuck it into the back of my own pants. Kreitzler came back out of the control house, running a hand through his hair and surveying the scene before him with evident, if rather amazed, satisfaction. Then he looked my way self-consciously, as if he knew what was coming.
"You are going to tell me what in hell is going on around here?"
Laszlo had just opened his mouth to reply when the sound of a sharp whistle echoed up from 40th Street. Kreitzler ran to peer over the street-side fence of the promenade, and I quickly joined him, looking down to see Cyrus and Stevie in the calash.
"I fear that explanations will have to wait, Moore. Cyrus and Stevie's arrival means that the opera has been over for at least 3/4 of an hour. By now, Roosevelt's suspicions have been thoroughly aroused. He'll have checked with the others at the Highbridge Tower, and when they learn of our disappearance..."
Quickly crossing over to where Beecham sat huddled, Kreitzler crouched down to stare him in the face, drawing a deep breath to calm himself. Then he held a hand in front of our prisoner's eyes and moved it back and forth. Beecham seemed utterly oblivious.
"The boy has come down from the mountains, or so it would seem."
I took his point. If the man we'd first encountered on the walls that night had been the evolved version of the cool, sadistic young trapper who'd once roamed the Shawangunks, then the terrified creature now before us was the inheritor of all the terror and self-loathing that Japheth Durie had felt at every other moment of his life.
"We revel in men like Beecham, Moore. They are the easy repositories of all that is dark in our very social world. But the things that helped make Beecham what he is, those we tolerate, those we even enjoy."
Evidently aware that there was little to fear from the man so long as he was in this mental state, Laszlo took Beecham's jacket from him and draped it around the man's huge, bare shoulders.
"Listen to me, Japheth Durie. You've a great deal of blood on your hands, that of your parents, not least of all. Should your crimes become known, your brother Adam, who is still alive and still attempting to carry on an honest, decent life, will most certainly be privately destroyed and publicly hounded. For that, if for no other reason, the part of you that is still human must pay close attention to me."
Though Beecham's eyes remained quite glassy, he nodded slowly.
"Good. The police will be here soon. They may or may not find you waiting when they arrive, depending on how honest you are with me. I'm going to ask you a few questions to determine your ability, as well as your willingness to cooperate. Answer these questions truly, and we may be able to arrange a less severe fate than that which the people of this city will demand. Do you understand?"
Beecham nodded again, and Kreitzler produced his ubiquitous little notebook and a pen.
"All right, then. The basic facts."
Laszlo then launched into a fast, condensed, yet calmly worded review of Beecham's life, beginning with his childhood as Japheth Durie, and going into some detail concerning the murder of his parents. As Beecham answered these queries, his tone became increasingly weak and helpless. For his part, Kreitzer became ever more satisfied by Beecham's earnest attempts to cooperate, finding in them proof positive that a hidden yet still strong part of the murderer's mind had indeed craved this moment. I suppose that I, too, should have been deeply gratified at the results of this initial interview, yet as I watched Beecham answer Laszlo's questions, his voice growing ever more compliant and even childish, with none of the threatening, arrogant tone he'd used when we were his prisoners, I became powerfully irritated, disturbed at the very core of my spirit. This irritation soon became outrage, as if this man had no right to exhibit any pitiable human qualities in light of all he'd done. Who was this enormous grotesque, I thought, to sit here, confessing and sniveling like one of the children he'd slaughtered? Where was all the violence, cruelty, arrogance, and unstoppability that he displayed on other nights? As these and similar questions shot through my head, my anger mounted rapidly until suddenly I was unable to contain the feelings any longer.
Shut up! Shut the hell up, you miserable coward!
Both Beecham and Laszlo immediately grew silent and looked up at me in shock. Beecham's facial spasms intensified dramatically as he eyed the Colt in my hand, while Laszlo's attitude soon changed from one of stunned surprise to chastising comprehension.
All right, Moore. Go and wait inside with the boy, then.
I leaned down, keeping the Colt pointed at Beecham's head.
Figure you can still get out of it, don't you?
Damn it, Moore. Stop!
I drew closer to Beecham's spasming face.
My friend thinks that people who aren't afraid to die are crazy.
With Laszlo trying to disarm me, I shoved the barrel of the revolver up against Beecham's throat.
Are you afraid to die? Are you? To die like the boys you... Moore!
But I was far past listening. Struggling to get my thumb on the hammer of the Colt, I pulled it back with a jerk, causing Beecham to let out a desperate little cry like a trapped animal.
No, you're not crazy. You are afraid to die.
With stunning suddenness, the air all around us was consumed by a gunshot. A resonant, slapping sort of impact sounded from somewhere just under my hand, and then Beecham rocked backward in a jerk, revealing a crimson-black hole in the left side of his chest that wheezed with the sound of escaping air. Fixing his small, straining eyes on me, Beecham slumped over, his jacket falling from his shoulders. I've killed him, I thought clearly. There was neither joy nor guilt in the realization, just a simple acknowledgement of fact. But then my gaze fell on the hammer of my Colt. It was still cocked. Before I could get my confused brain to make any sense of this sight, Laszlo had jumped over to Beecham and made a cursory examination of the bullet wound. Shaking his head as the unpleasant sound of gushing air and blood continued to come out of Beecham's chest, Laszlo made a fist and looked up furiously. His glare, however, was directed past me, and following it, I turned around slowly. Connor had somehow slipped his bonds and was standing in the center of the promenade. His back was bent with dizziness and pain, and he held a small, crude, twin-barreled pistol. A twisted smile came into his bleeding mouth, and then he staggered forward a step or two.
It ends tonight. Drop it, Moore.
I complied, slowly and carefully. But just as the Colt touched the pathway, another gunshot cut through the air, this one from farther off, and then Connor jerked forward as if he'd been struck hard in the back. He fell on his face with a small grunt, revealing a hole in his jacket, out of which blood began to pump immediately. The powder smoke from the shot Connor had fired at Beecham had not even cleared when a new figure stepped forward on the dark promenade and became visible in the moonlight. It was Sarah, pearl-gripped revolver in hand. She stared down at Connor for an instant without betraying any emotion, then looked up at Kreitzer and me. I thought of this place just after we'd gotten into position at Highbridge Tower. When Theodore said you'd left the opera, I knew. The Isaacsons appeared in the darkness behind her.
And where is the commissioner?
Out searching. We didn't tell him.
Thank you, Sarah. You had little reason for such consideration.
Sarah's expression remained impassive.
You're right.
Beecham suddenly let out with a bloody, choking cough, and Kreitzer got an arm under his neck, bringing the large head up. Laszlo reached into his pocket, brought out a small vial of ammonia salts and wafted them under Beecham's nose.
Japheth. Japheth Durie, can you hear me?
Beecham's eyelids fluttered for an instant and then opened, the dulling orbs beneath them rolling helplessly about in his head. Finally, he fixed them on the face that was very close to his own. He wasn't spasming now, and his expression was that of a terrified child who looks to a stranger for help that he somehow knows he isn't going to get.
I'm... I'm going to die. Listen to me, Japheth. You must listen to me. What did you see, Japheth? What did you see when you looked at the children? What made you kill them?
Beecham's head began to shake from side to side quickly, and then a shudder went through his body. He turned his terrified gaze to the heavens.
Japheth, what did you see?
As his head continued to shake, Beecham's eyes shifted back to Laszlo's pleading face.
I have never known. I have never known. I didn't. They.
The shaking in his face spread throughout his body for an instant, and then he grabbed Laszlo by the shirt. Face still full of mortal fear, John Beecham spasmed one final time and grew still. His head rolled away from Kreitzler, the eyes finally losing their expression of terror.
Japheth!
But Kreitzler knew it was too late, and he lowered the dead man's head down to the cold stone beneath it. Much later that night, heading downtown, I came to a stop at the corner of Great Jones Street. Looking down the block, I saw that the lights of the New Brighton Dance Hall were still burning bright. Perhaps explanations were not so far off after all, I thought. And then, before I'd consciously decided to go, my feet were carrying me toward the place. I was still several doors away when I started to hear loud music, raucous laughter, and a few drunken screams. Not relishing the prospect of actually going inside, I was much relieved to see Paul Kelly emerge from the joint's frosted glass doors just as I arrived. With him was a police sergeant, in uniform, who was laughing and counting a wad of money. Kelly glanced over, caught a sight of me, and then elbowed the cop, telling him with a nod to get lost. The sergeant obliged, scurrying obediently away in the general direction of Mulberry Street.
"Well, Moore."
He pulled a small snuff box out of his silk vest and grinned in his handsome way.
"I see that you're in one piece. From the rumors that are floating around town, I'd say you're damned lucky."
"Come on, Kelly. I saw your rig tonight. You and your man McManus saved our necks."
"Jack?"
Kelly opened the snuff box, revealing a mound of finely ground cocaine.
"Why, he didn't tell me. Doesn't sound like Jack, though, to go around doing good deeds."
Kelly put a little cocaine on one knuckle and snorted it hard, then held the box out to me.
"Care for some?"
"No, thanks. Listen, the best I can figure is that you made some kind of deal with Kreitzler."
"Deal?"
His affected ignorance started to make me testy. "All right. I've been through entirely too much tonight to stand out here playing who knows what with you, Kelly. Tell Jack he's got a favor coming." At that, I stormed off, or tried my best to, anyway. But I'd only gotten half the distance to the corner when I heard Kelly's voice again.
"Say, Moore."
I turned around and saw him grinning.
"Sounds like you people had a hell of a time. I'm not saying I know anything about it, of course. But ask yourself this when you get a free moment. Of all the people who were up there tonight, who do you think is really the most dangerous to the money boys uptown?"
I stood there staring dumbly at Kelly and then at the ground, trying to make sense out of his question. After half a minute, an answer started to form in my overworked brain, and my jaw dropped open a little bit. I glanced back up with a grin and was about to state my reply, but Kelly was nowhere to be seen. However, I knew what he meant, and understood what he had done. Paul Kelly, gangland thief, inveterate gambler and amateur philosopher and social critic, was playing a hunch on Kreitzler. And though none of us would likely live long enough to see the ultimate outcome of the game, I suspected that his hunch was correct. I look back across almost 23 years now to the end of the case. Kreitzler and I are old men, and New York is a very different place. Thanks to Theodore and many of his political allies, we have been transformed into a great power, and New York is more than ever the crossroads of the world.